All right, so we back with the Hip Hop Social Worker podcast, but this is the Pivot. I am back podcasting, you know what I'm saying? But this podcast run is going to be called Social Work, Sneakers, and Storytelling. Now, that is really just kind of the epitome of me, you know what I'm saying? You know, I don't have the hugest sneaker collection, you know what I'm saying? But I do love sneakers. I do love, when fresh shit come out, I do love to, you know, spend my money, because I feel like Nike and that sneakers app, they tricked us to, you know what I'm saying, to feeling privileged when we get to spend our money, you know what I'm saying? So when we hit, we feel like we lucky to give them out our hard-earned cash. But I feel it because we love to do it, you know what I'm saying? Because sneakers is a part of me. I feel like it's a part of my it's actually a part of like my social work practice, you know what I'm saying? I feel like, you know, when I wear sneakers, you know what I'm saying, fresh sneakers, people always notice. People always say, oh shit, like what? Like Chris always got the, you know what I'm saying, something on his feet. So I feel like that feels good to me. That was like a part of my, you know, when I was a young kid, and I really couldn't, you know, afford to get my shit off like that. I said, man, when I get some ends, I'm going to make sure that I got some, you know what I'm saying, some heat, you know what I'm saying? But I got my guy, you know what I'm saying, Gary Trey Taylor, LCSW extraordinaire, you know what I'm saying? When I talk to these social workers, right, no shade to the people who are out there getting their grind on in therapy, you know what I'm saying? We all know that therapy is like the most consistent way to make a good living in social work, you know what I'm saying? If you really want to get like, you know what I'm saying, $150,000 a year, $200,000 a year, you can grind your shit out in therapy and really become a person who, like, you know, makes some good capital, right? You can really do that. But like I said, it's a grind, you know what I'm saying? And everybody doesn't really want to go through that grind, and that's okay. But people are also making a nice living not doing therapy. So we're trying to figure out, I'm trying to like introduce really social work students, you know what I'm saying, people who are trying to figure it out, who feel like they have to go that route. There's different ways to do it. And my man Gary Trey Taylor, he is a therapist, but you know what I'm saying, you know, he's pivoting away from that, and he's put a lot of work into doing a lot of other things. But if you listen to this podcast before, you've probably heard him a few times. But yeah, if you haven't, I'm going to go ahead and let him introduce himself.
Yes, sir. What's up, Chris? Welcome back. I'm glad you're back. The Pod Father is back. Podcaster. my man. I definitely love the way that you reintroduced this series with social work, sneakers, and storytelling, because that's also part of my journey as well. And I'm heavy into sneakers as well. I think that's one of the pieces that gives us the opportunity to connect with other people. First thing we do is check each other's feet. Boom, that's a conversation starter. So my name is Gary Trey Taylor, licensed clinical social worker out here in Virginia, in a little small county of Caroline County, Virginia. I am a therapist. I have my own practice called Uphold 318, which is a consulting practice, but also a private practice where I, you know, provide individual therapy, mostly virtual, to Black men and Black women throughout the state of Virginia. On the other side of that, my consulting side and speaking facilitation, I do a lot of work around, you know, do a lot of workshops around mental wellness, mental well-being, facilitation around racial justice, social justice, and equity initiatives. Doing a lot of that, partnerships with different agencies and speaking in the community. Also a 3-time published author. Last recent book was Refresh the Journey to Find Peace. Self-help memoir that talks about a lot of different things that I've dealt with in my past and growing up, and then grief and loss is a major theme of the book. And so that came out. That's available on Amazon, you know, Books and Noble, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, things like that. And then also I'm a podcaster as well, the G Taylor Show, that's on Apple Podcasts as well. That was kind of started and inspired by the Hip Hop Social Work podcast. So I'm always honored to just, you know, be a guest and work with Chris on a bunch of different things. And then also I'm an assistant professor now at Virginia State University in the social work department. I'm assistant professor, and I teach some new and upcoming MSW social work students as well, preparing them for this space of social work. You know, what I was thinking about when I woke up this morning and thinking about the trajectory of my career and where it has led me. And, you know, I started my private practice in 2020 at the height of the pandemic and was set out to do something that was not done a lot, right? And I had colleagues that helped me out. They were starting their private practices or had started it already. We all had left the same job and we were venturing out, you know, into doing these things. So I had some of that, you know, to kind of guide me. But I exclusively wanted to work with Black men and also ended up getting Black women and, you know, other races and ethnicities as well. But my primary focus wanted to be Black men. And that was off of what I seen with the Goodfellas Project. And that's on our first episode we started talking about, where creative social work episode, where we were creating a space for Black men to vent and heal and doing that ongoing. But I realized that that was also the template for providing individual therapy. And then also we used that Goodfellas model pretty much for facilitation, Brothers in Social Work Collective, which we'll talk about later, you know, things like that. And I didn't realize how much that would be a template for what I do today. But that's what I set out to do in 2020, man. And it has been a road that has been very, very fruitful and super exciting. But also it has its, you know, tough moments and how I'm gonna make ends meet, fighting with insurance companies, making sure people, you know, are showing up to session, making sure that I am doing the best thing I need to be doing as far as a therapist. And then also fighting the business aspect of it, right? And so if we were talking about the business of private practice episode, I can go on for days about that, but we're not. And so one of the things that I think is, you know, was dope about entrepreneurship is that I was tired of the 9-to-5, the hustle and bustle, the bureaucracy of these different agencies that I was working with. I had the license and I said, I'm gonna go ahead and venture out. I didn't have a template, but I looked up to like different OG social workers in the field, like, you know what I'm saying, Bashe Williams out in Maryland, Aaron Mueller out in New York, and, you know, Rashawn Miller out in Charlotte. They was kind of my OGs in the sense of just kind of looking at what they do in the field. And I wanted to do just that. And so I kind of built my practice and built my kind of brand around how they done their stuff as well. And then also just looking at what, you know, what you did, Chris, at Hip Hop Social Work and other colleagues and things like that, just kind of making sure that, okay, I can do it, but it's just not being done in Virginia. And so what's crazy is that those opportunities. So when I was in business doing therapy, I was also doing speaking engagements. I was consulting. I was, doing a lot of one-off type things in the community. And that's really how I got the job at Virginia State. It wasn't like, it really was because of my entrepreneurship. And so I do want to tell people, social workers, the therapists, like, you could treat your entrepreneurship time as a pretty much a CV resume tick that will allow you to get into whatever space you want to get into. And one of the other things is understanding that, too, those skills that you learn in entrepreneurship, that we have to figure out the sessions, the business side of it, the marketing, all that. That is skills that translates into leadership qualities in certain spaces, in the 9-to-5 space, things like that, or whatever you want to do, consulting space, facilitation space, things like that. And so how I got on Virginia State was because one of my colleagues, she was working down there. And she told me, she said, man, listen, she's like, I wanted to get you to come to a class, right? To just, you know, do a drop in time where we just kind of do drop in and speak, you know, talk about what we've done in the field. And she said, I seen you in 3 different places in 3 different entities. And I said, no, I got to reach out to him and see if he want to teach. So she was thinking about me for coming to guest lecture. She saw me on, I was doing Richmond Black Mental Health Week in October. So I did the sneakers and mental health, that. And I was coming off the barbershop training 1.0 that I did with my old employer, where we was talking about mental health at the barbershop in September. And she said she seen all 3 of those things at the same time. And she was like, you know what, I got to reach out and see if you want to teach. So that's how I got into that space. And now while I'm down there now, all the stuff that I do, right, it's like okay, now it's not just the Uphold brand, it's not just Trey, the social worker, and the licensed clinical social worker. It's now, oh, this assistant professor from Virginia State University also does this type of stuff, right? So now it's extra layer, extra branding. And that only, I think, helps the program, right? Because we're building from the ground up. But also it helps give students and, you know, future potential social workers, especially Black social workers, to know, hey, you can do this and you can do that and you can do this, right? And still, you know, and tap into those different spaces. So entrepreneurship was a bridge to get me back into, you know, a regular 9-to-5 job too. So it's wild to see how that panned out, because I didn't see that. I honestly didn't see that pan out when I jumped out there into entrepreneurship, for sure.
Right. And I feel like when people think entrepreneurship and leaving like the 9-to-5, I feel like they don't want to go back. Right. Mm-hmm. But entrepreneurship is like freedom. Like that's what people chase, right? The freedom. Right. Yeah. So like the freedom is that, like, if I want to go back to 9-to-5 work, I can do that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when you said like using entrepreneurship to build up your resume per se, I mean, there's a few people that I know. One of them is Ian Williams, you know what I'm saying? He's looking for, you know what I'm saying, just a role somewhere, right? And right. I'm sure it's just for something to do, you know what I'm saying? To, like, you know, build his kind of persona, right?
Right.
His professional, you know, everybody trying to build a professional cape, right? We're trying to make our professional, you know, briefcase look so ironclad that when we step anywhere, you know, like, they gotta respect us, right? There's also one guy, I think his name was, I can't remember his name, but I can't front. But he had his own private practice for 12 years out in Hood River County, where he like serviced like sex offenders, youth,
in
Central Oregon. So for 12 years, he did his own business. And when he came back 9-to-5 work, there was a job at, like, you know, being the head of juvenile in Hood River County, and he got that job.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, especially if you got, like, you know what I'm saying, like your license, or you have an idea that can kind of, like, you know, pivot into something that could be a little fruitful, you know what I'm saying, to carry you. You can do all the grind, all the work, and then you can, like, some sweet comes your way, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, I remember, you know, you going through the Virginia State process, you really didn't have to do much, you know what I'm saying? It was like somebody said, hey, meet with this person. The next day, you was like, well, I guess I'm teaching in January, you know? So
it was quick, fast. You know, what's interesting, man. So I did want to go back to 9-to-5. And so if I did, it had to be something sweet. It had to be something that was flexible. And but I had to make a decision too, because, you know, with business, family, personal, you know, and everything I've done so far, I was like, man, I gotta figure out something, because I'm gonna run myself, you know, ragged in this sense. And because I know how I grind and I hustle, I go like 110%, sometimes too far. You know what I'm saying? So I gotta scale it back. But I sat here and thought about one thing. I remember when I was working at my old job in crisis, I had reached out to Mental Health America, the national spot. And I told them that I wanted to, you know, partner with them or do some stuff with them, right? And the girl on the phone, she was like, yo, that's great, all the ideas you have. And I think this was around the time my first book was getting ready to come out or was out. And I said, you know, I want to talk more about Black mental health. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I want to see how can we get partnered, right? And one of the things she told me, she was like, yeah, you got great ideas. You got, you know, whatever, but have you done any of these things, right? And I said, well, no, I haven't at all. I thought that I could work with y'all so we can help build that, right? And she was like, well, Mental Health America typically looks for somebody who's already has something in place or done it, pretty much in a kind of, you know, summarizing aspect. And then we can look at how it fits or partners. And that was like 2016, 2017. And realistically, I didn't have anything at that point in time outside of my community group, which was UIE and Stop the Violence. And I kind of took it. She's like, there's no issue, but I just want to let you know, like, this is how it kind of works. So when you do develop these things or come back with these things, you know, let us know, hit us up. And I was driving the road and I thought about that thing, man. And I realized, I was like, wow, like, I have created that thing that they was looking for, because now they pushing like more the equity in Mental Health America and making sure that Black mental health is highlighted. But now I have partnered with Mental Health America and my local chapter to help provide supervision for the intern that they have for them. And now I get to take what I've created from my business structure, right, in the last 2 to 3 years, but it's really been really 6 to 7 years since 2017, since I started it, taking everything I've done since then, showing proof. I can show you Goodfellas. I can show you the private practice. I can show you the speaking engagements. I can show you everything. So you're not just getting me for just a thought or an idea. No, I can say I want to do a racial equity training, and I can point to this stuff right here. You know what I'm saying? And it's just, it was so wild to kind of think about that in this last 6 to 7 year period. And also, it's also the reason why I got this job for being a teacher and an assistant professor. That's something I didn't even think was possible, because I thought I needed a PhD or a doctorate. I thought that's what I needed at that point. And they was like, nah, you good. We can work with that, because you do all these other things outside of school. And this is what we were looking for in professors. So I was like, oh, all right, cool.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think, like, you know, being a professor, like being a teacher, like you can be a teacher with a bachelor's degree, right? But it's very rare that they'll do that, right? So
right,
it's like,
right.
So being a professor is like, you know, saying, yes, we want, you know, you to have a PhD or DSW or whatever kind of doctorate, right? But realistically, with MSW, you can be a professor, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's, yeah. So how does it feel, you know what I'm saying? Let me back up. How did you come to that decision to, you know what, I'm shutting down the practice, I'm moving on to more facilitation, you know what I'm saying, really letting academia be my vehicle to kind of get me to those places that we've talked about for, you know what I'm saying, for years since we've met, you know what I'm saying, talking about doing groups, doing facilitation, you know, traveling the country, right, working in workshops, you know what I'm saying? We still got to get a tour cracking. I feel like, you know what I'm saying, Lord willing, you know what I'm saying, we'll, you know what I'm saying, we'll string something together one of these days. But but how did you get to that feeling to where, like, you know, all right, my money maker, letting it go, I'm gonna move on to something else and just kind of let, you know what I'm saying, academia be that wheelhouse?
I came to that process by listening to my body. I was telling one of my homegirls, my colleague, yesterday about this. I made the decision. I was getting ready to expand my practice. Remember, I was talking to you about that. I was like, you know, so I'm going to see about these grants, and I'm going to see if I can expand it and move into an owner kind of role where I'm just owning and have this agency. And I thought it would be dope to create a Black mental health agency, right? And I'm still not opposed to that, right? I just need to fund it. I'm pretty sure I could build a Black mental health agency, a private practice where social workers and therapists can come and they can go between, you know, doing therapy and nonprofit work, right? So I'm not, that's still out there. I just need some dollars. And that's what I told myself. I said, well, if I get this grant, I'll expand it, right? But I'm not expanding it on my own dollar or dime at this point, because it's going to take too much heavy lifting. I knew how much heavy lifting it took to get that private practice up the way I did. And I grinded it out, right? And I figured it out. But now, you know, you go through it, you learn, you more experienced, you know better. So I know how to. So even if something happens where I want to go back to full-time private practice, or I feel like I'm just not moving the way I want to, I can go back full-time if I want to, because I know how to navigate it now. And but so that was my thought pattern. I came into teaching, and I was teaching, and I got sick twice between January and April. I got COVID and I got strep throat. I got COVID the first part of it. I got COVID actually before my first, no, wasn't my first? Yes, I caught COVID before my second class in this last semester. And like the first class teacher, like, everybody positive in the house. You know what I'm saying? And I wasn't positive, ended up positive that Sunday night or that Monday or whatever. And had to teach it virtual the first time, the second class of my first time teaching. and just, you know, figure it out. But then I got through the semester, got my legs, and I had been toying with the idea of trying to feel like I might need to shut this private practice down, but I felt guilty. I was like, I'm letting my clients down. I'm letting the community down. We don't already got enough therapists. You know, where are they going to go? Yada, yada, yada. But at the same point in time, clients were getting better. They were not coming in as frequent. And they were also moving out as well. So it was a natural progression on both sides, too. And so I got to April. I got strep throat, which was probably one of the worst things I've ever had in a long time. And that jump put me under for a week. And it's crazy because, like, these things attack your mouthpiece, right? And that's our job. And so you start affecting that, man. It's hard, man, to get back. And so I said, you know, oh, Trey, you're going to make a decision, right? You're going to have to make a decision because you want to teach. You're feeling good about academia. You can, and I will talk about that too, why I feel like academia is a good space for me to kind of pivot into, because it still gives me that business aspect and creative aspect, because I like to build things, right? I like to craft and build stuff from the ground up, and I have success doing that, right? I've done it. It's my second business doing that, building something from the ground up. And I was tired. I was exhausted. I was talking to y'all about this. I was tired, man. And yeah, but you know, rightfully so, teaching two classes, never really teaching at an academic level, but knowing how to teach and facilitate. But teaching 3-hour long classes, grading papers, you know, trying to keep up with stuff. And I also wasn't fully immersed into the program like I wanted to, because I leave from down, you know, state, commute, come on back, do my sessions, get ready for house, home, personal life, stuff like that. And I said, you know what, man, I'm gonna go ahead and see. It's my thought is there, but I'm gonna figure it out. I'm gonna go on vacation. I hadn't made a decision yet, but I'm gonna go on vacation and I'm gonna see what my body tells me. Mm-hmm. All right. And if it's just me being reactionary, right? Or is it really me just time to go ahead and transition, right? And I was adamant about that, because I was going to figure it out. Either I was going to expand, and when that grant didn't come in, I was like, okay, well, I'm not expanding now. And I thought about running it. I said, man, I'm just going to keep the caseload, keep moving, right? You know, and do what I need to do. And I was like, man, well, let me just see. And so I had a week off where I wasn't answering no emails, no phone calls, no sessions. Just, you know, being at the beach with my family, being present. And I felt my body telling me, yo, like, we got to slow it down. We got to figure something else out. This ain't going to move the way we're going to move, because this stretch going from August to October is going to be hectic, right? And it's going to be super hectic. And I'm looking at forecasting my sessions. I'm like, I don't even know if I'm going to be available sometime in October to even do sessions, right? And I did not want to get in that habit, because I prided myself on being present at every session with my clients. I hated rescheduling. I hated canceling sessions. But I had to get in the habit. If I was sick, I wasn't feeling it that day, I had to, reschedule and cancel. And that took some time, right? Mm-hmm. Because I feel like if I wasn't present, I was letting my clients down, and I am missing prime opportunity for my client who probably doesn't get no time ever to talk, you know what I'm saying, or process their feelings. I'm giving that up because I'm not taking care of myself, which is a double-edged sword at times. And I was looking at that, I was thinking about that, and I was like, you know what, man? I think it is time to shut it down. And it was a very firm decision, right? And one of the things that, you know, I'm definitely spiritual and Christian, but I was asking God about it as well. And, you know, the thing that I was searching for something, I was finally trying to find something was popping up, and he was like, you know, family, right? And that was the resonating theme throughout the summer that popped up for me, that word. And that kind of also told me that, okay, this is what I need to probably do and figure out, because I've done it. I've been somewhat successful with it. I had some failures, but I don't think they're a failure. I think they just was, you know, learning curves. And now it's time to fully, I've given you this opportunity to go to state to teach, and you can still do some of the stuff you've been doing in your practice, but you could do it here and still not have to worry about finances, not have to worry about where this funding is coming from.
If they've got a budget, we can do it. If not, you can create it in your aspect, in your classroom, or in office hours or whatever. So well, I've seen the opportunity to take what I've done in business and what I love to do with y'all and, you know, out in the community, and I could take it and bring it to an academic program. Then I was like, oh, so it'd still be the same thing without less hassle, without less stress. You know what I'm saying? So some of the stuff that may stress people out, you know, at the 9-to-5, at the academic level, it might not stress me out because you never ran a business. But like, if you never ran a business before and had to figure out how you're going to pay the office expenses and your personal expenses, and insurance not bringing in the money, insurance got you holding your checks up. You know what I'm saying? That's another navigation that you got to, that's a skill that you can't, that some, what's going on in the department, y'all acting stupid in the department, whatever, that don't equate to that. You know what I'm saying? So whatever. Okay. Yeah, cool. Whatever. It is what it is. You know what I'm saying? Keep moving. You know what I'm saying? So that also helps build up the, I think, the patience and the tolerance too. So that's why I say those skills translate. And so when I figured that out, man, I was like, man, all right, I think it's time. And I was wanted to go to December because that would be my 3-year, like official 3-year mark. But I really did not want my clients to be impacted by my goals and ambitions, right? And I was like, if I can just go ahead and cut it in September and get them the opportunity to find somebody that can continue to work with them, then that would be better than stringing them along knowing that I'm going to close it down in December anyway. So, no, that's a little long with it. I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. And academia is powerful. You know what I'm saying? Like, academia is powerful. Like, just how, like, you talk about, like, you know, your institution sending you to conferences, right? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, I work in education, right? You know what I'm saying? But, like, I still got to do some things to get sent to a conference, right? And academia is kind of like, you know, you go and you bring back that knowledge to expand, you know, what we got going on, right? You know what I'm saying? You go listen to Dr. whoever, right? You know what I'm saying? You go listen to them, you come back with some ideas, because I mean, in reality, academia is a business. You know what I'm saying? Like, if your program's booming, we can do a lot more stuff, and that only comes when you are like at your best, right? So I mean, that's one thing. I mean, you know, I think about, like, kind of like, you know, my pivot, it's like, man, like, it would be dope, you know what I'm saying, to get in academia. You know what I'm saying? Just for that reason, you know what I'm saying? It'd be like, you know, to be able to kind of put you at a different, you just at a different level, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, like, and it's a level that's not like anything else, you know what I'm saying? So, but one thing, your theme is working with Black men, Black people, right? So when I came up with the decision to not get my LCSW, you know what I'm saying? People kept saying, like, well, you know, saying, like, the Black men need you, right? But I was like, I decided to you know, renounce that idea, because I feel like the clinical space is the only space for us to heal,
right?
You know what I'm saying? So, like, how do you feel, like, you know, when it comes to you know, us needing to provide those services for Black men, right? You know what I'm saying? 'Cause that's what they want us to do, right? You know what I'm saying? How do you feel like you can expand beyond, you know what I'm saying, working with Black men in the clinical aspect? All right. Man, so we was talking about helping Black men outside of the clinical space, right? You know what I'm saying? Because, like I said before, people, when I was talking about not getting my LCSW, actually, that was the pitch to get, because when I got out of grad school, I was like, I had a professor that was like so anti-LCSW. I was like, you know what? I like that idea. You know what I'm saying? Because I already knew that, like, that process was going to be hell for me to do. But people, so many people was like, man, if you get that, you're going to need, you know, these Black men, they need you. They need therapy. They need this. They need that. I feel like Charlamagne gassed them. But whatever. but whatever. You know what I'm saying? But so I got, like, you know, I got talked into getting it, you know what I'm saying? My two coworkers that did convince me to do it, they got the LCSW, they doing fine, they thriving, you know what I'm saying? They doing their thing.
Right.
But I want to kind of fight back to that idea that I need to be some kind of clinical-based person to work with Black people, you know what I'm saying? So go ahead and, like, you know, say, like, what are ways we can do that without being so, like, entrenched in, like, that clinical system?
Oh boy, you threw a lot, boy. I catch that like Vince Carter. We talked about this, right? It is not fair to tell a black male social worker or a black woman social worker that, oh, well, you should keep your license or keep your practice so you continue to help the black community. Because if you look at the grand scheme of this, like, you know, you asked me this question, I went online just to make sure I was citing my sources correctly. Only 4%, black male therapists only make up 4% of the therapist population. 4%. Right. So it is impossible to meet the demand of all black men who need therapy. Goodfellas Project was created before I got my license. Goodfellas Project is probably one of my most successful projects I've ever done. And I've done a lot. And it's the template, I think, for working with black men, right? And it had nothing to do with clinical base. I would throw clinical stuff in there because I can do that, but it was real life stuff. If you get men together, black men together, in a space that is safe, they trust one another, and we got rapport, we can conquer the world. It's evident in historical factors. You know what I'm saying? And therapy is a tool. Some do need it, but it's not the end all be all. Now, I know some interventions that I think would be beneficial, but, you know, I just, you know, that's just one part of it, right? You know, and depending on what is needed, if it's trauma, PTSD, you know, things like that, or, you know, what type of intervention is needed. And again, the interventions that we use in therapy are whitewashed. They're not, you know, evidence-based, but they're whitewashed. They're not, a lot of times, not specific to us as black men. So I have to pick and choose and modify on how I utilize these things to help black men heal, right? But there are other alternatives to helping them heal, right? We're communal people, right? So if we can, and that's the reason I started Goodfellas. I realized that, and this was before LCSW, that I would watch my pops hang out in the garage from 7-8 o'clock when all his homeboys got off until 12-1 o'clock in the morning, right? They doing whatever, you know what I'm saying? But they talking, laughing, playing music, doing whatever. And I saw that and I started emulating that myself with my homeboy. So we'd be sitting out in the garage, so we just chilling outside, just talking about life. Or we'd be in my basement, we just sitting there chilling and talking about life, whatever. And so that's what I saw, where black men come to decompress. Now, libations, whatever it might have been, right? That's your choice. Hopefully you're doing it in a healthy manner. But I saw that and I said, man, you know, that's a safe space for black men, right? When they get together and they do their thing, we do it all the time, unknowingly, right? Where we'll sit outside and sit in the parking lot and just chill and talk about everything, or we leave in an event and we still supposed to leave, but we still talking. Then we say, I'm about to bounce, and then continue talking and leaving. You know what I'm saying? That is part of, I think, who we are as a people. And I think you can build from that to help brothers heal, right? That's not clinical based. You know, is there a place for clinical base? Yes. But to not think outside of the box in reference to trying to help black men heal and get the necessary stuff that they need, it's not fair. And then to tell incoming black professionals, especially from my white colleagues, that, oh, well, you'd be so good to help, you know, your community or black men, black women or whatever. And to tell them that's limiting too, because aren't you supposed to be also be able to help that population as well? Right. So the training, I'm doing a training today where I'm talking to a multitude of different therapists about, hey, it can't just be all on black therapists or black social workers to help the black community heal. Right.
Right.
You're going to have to figure out and get through your own bias to help work with that community and your own fear and biases. If you have fear and biases, you need to address why, because the actual discipline that you're in does not, you know, have any space for that, whether it's social work or counseling or whatever. You're supposed to be non-biased. So why are you bringing bias into this room? You feel what I'm saying? Why are you in this field? You cannot expect the 4% of black male therapists to meet the demand. And that's just, I mean, to me, that still is still, I would say, structural racism, you know? So there are opportunities, man. Like, you know, we've talked about doing stuff. We've done stuff with the Brothers of Social Work Collective, where we've met with young brothers and or all ages, really, on the campuses or virtually, to help give them support in these spaces. We've done Goodfellas Project in different variations, whether it's the barbershop training. I've done barbershop trainings. Chris has done barbershop trainings. We've done these type of different things and had success. And the other piece of it that I also want to say is that to say that black men don't want to attend therapy or don't want to get help, I don't think that's true. I really don't. I've seen brothers be consistent in therapy for 2 to 3 years, barely missing a session. I've seen brothers want to attend and these Goodfellas type style projects or these whatever, and these barbershop trainings, they come and attend, they want to learn. But if there's not a safe space, they're not coming. You know what I'm saying? Or you trying to force them to go to something they don't want to do, they're not coming. I get that question all the time. How do you get your man, your son, whatever? You can't force them. You know what I'm saying? And then people also want rapid results, to see rapid change from those men, and thinking that's going to happen just in a year, a few months. And it's like, do you know how much stuff that has been built up that they have never had the opportunity to talk about? You think we're going to get through all of that in just a year, 6 months, right? You know, it is a process. And I had a colleague tell me when I got into this work, man, doing work, she was like, it is going to be heavy work. And I was like, yeah, you're right. It's going to be heavy work. I'm going to figure it out. You know what I'm saying? And she was like, you probably need to build in this self-care thing to help do that. And it did not really, I didn't abide by her warning, because it is heavy work. And when it's heavy work, right, that burden weighs on you daily. And if you don't have a strong enough self-care plan to get into it, to address it, right, it continues to weigh on. And that was I was dealing with, right? I could not recuperate fast enough. Right. But it's the burden. It's the weight of the work. You know what I'm saying? And so just, you know, like that, it almost like when people say that, like you say, oh, well, you know, you can help the black community. Let me do it in a pace or a way that I want to give my time and talents and efforts. Let me not just do it because you say I need to do it because you feel like there's a need. Like, I feel like you feel like I'd be a good mentor to this young boy. Well, if I mentor this young boy, but I got 10,000 other things that he didn't do, I'm going to continue to perpetuate the cycle of lost people in his life at the same time. So now right. He's going to look at mental professionals or social workers away because they were fragmented, not in the space as much as he needed them to be. Or I didn't know how much he needed me to be there, but I got these other obligations going on too. You feel what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, that's why I never really got into mentorship like that, because I know how hectic my life can be. And I don't want to break the cycle of consistency that person maybe already have. Right. So, you know, it's just. I feel like when they say that to us sometimes, it almost feels racist. It almost does. It just really does. And it's just like, there's no way. And then even to say if the therapy room is not political, that we can't talk about, we shouldn't talk about these different things that affect these men in session when it comes up all of the time in session. So if you're scared of that, what are you doing? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's, you don't feel like that's supposed to be in session, but that's what affects this person who has been a marginalized, who has been oppressed, or maybe feeling it on the job right now, microaggressions, things like that, discrimination. But you do think that's not a place for therapy room.
Right.
You know, so I. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to stop right there.
No, but, you know, like, when you hear those things, like, you know, when you, like, kind of a baby social worker, right, like, you feel like it's a compliment, right? Like, mm-hmm. Oh, man, you say, you think I would be good, I could make a lot of money or whatever, but then at the same time, it's like, well, I know a lot of people who reach out to, you know, black men who have programs that don't have degrees, you know what I'm saying? So, like, for you to pigeonhole me, and then, like, trying to feed me into, like, this system that kind of eats its own, You know what I'm saying? I just feel like we got to be more creative. You know what I'm saying? Like there's ways to do it. There's ways, like you said, the barbershop talks. You know what I'm saying? Partner with somebody. I partner with my guy, you know, Black Men's Wellness PDX. He's always, you know, we've done several workshops that have, you know, he used like my credentials as like a vehicle, you know what I'm saying? But when we get into those rooms, it ain't clinical. It's just us like just kind of talking, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, but then that brings us to Brothers in Social Work Collective, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like when I was podcasting heavily, I was getting more like, I was getting more opportunities to come and speak to people, mm-hmm. right? So I feel like, you know, I will, you're the clinical guy in the group, you know what I'm saying? You're the one that comes and shuts shit down. JB is the, you know, he's the organizer, he's the proposer, he's the talker. I feel like I could be the, you know, like the promoter, you know what I'm saying? The person that's gonna come and just speak, you know what I'm saying, on the microphone and kind of push our agenda, you know what I'm saying? Because I feel like when I was talking, like, you know, when I was doing episode a week, I mean, I was busy out here, you know? So I feel like, you know, that's probably one part component that's missing. It's like just somebody who can like just put like, you know, some time towards it, you know what I'm saying? And if I'm podcasting, I might as well, you know, do the same thing I was doing before, you know, like just go ahead and get into it. But, you know, when we started that, you know what I'm saying, that was kind of a way to break free from like the traditional, you know what I'm saying, one-on-one sessions, right? It was like a group of Black people, you know what I'm saying, talking to either professionals or talking to other Black men, like, hey, this is what social work is. And we're trying to really prepare you for, you know what I'm saying, just this career, you know what I'm saying? So, like, I feel like even with, like, you know, social work is more than therapy, I'm trying to prepare people, you know what I'm saying, for this career, because it can get tricky, it can get lonely, it can get confusing, it can get, because it's not as glowing as you think when you're in grad school, you think that it's like an oppression-free career, you know what I'm saying? You're still in a system.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I'm saying? You're still in a system that, like I said, eats its own, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. In the last few years, I know a lot of social work, I won't say a lot, but I know a few social workers that have went against, like, you know, the beast and left and did something totally different, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we're trying to keep people here because it is good work to do, and you can make a, you know, like, you can have a comfortable life doing this work, you know what I'm saying? But that's me speaking to my brother in social work, you know what I'm saying? How do you feel like, you know what I'm saying, like, the future for us, you know what I'm saying, can work out?
I think we just need a bigger shot. I think if we get a bigger shot, you know, I envision realistic when I thought about it, us three for sure. And then when I thought about more, I was like, man, I could see this being like a bigger entity, whereas like a big consulting agency. And I still think that's possible. It's just, you know, we got to put the, you know, rubber to the road with it. But also people got to take a chance on us. And we do really come in with a very, very social justice, racial justice approach to it. But we also provide that support for students as well. That I think just you can see is a need, is a big, 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 big need. You know, when I thought about it, man, because we was all doing the kind of the same thing. And I was like, why don't we just put our minds together and just do something bigger? And we all have our different levels of expertise to kind of make that work. And people, and you know, people can, social work students, Black, white, you know what I'm saying, men, women, you know what I'm saying, anybody, that they can see different varying levels of what we can do, right? You know, and how that can be impactful in the social work space. I think people have to also understand the social work field too. Like, this is what I tell students, how when you get into these agencies, right, they don't follow the NASW code of ethics. They don't follow what social work principles are. So how do you handle, you know, navigating that space that might go against how you've been traditionally trained or your own moralistic values? You feel what I'm saying? Right. Or your morals and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? How do you combat that? How do you deal with that? How do you push through that? And so Stuff like that that don't really get talked about in the classroom. I know it doesn't because it has nothing. It doesn't say it in these books that I've been teaching. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't say it at all. And what I try to do is tell students, you know, like the real, what the field is. And I think that's where we come in as an asset and a resource to let them know, hey, this is what the real social work looks like when you get out here, right? This is what the book say. It's what the internships say. When you get out here, this is what you're going to deal with and what you go through, and this is how you navigate through it. And you get it from all varying levels, from the community level, meso level with you, and then also the macro level with Doc, and then also with the clinical base level with me as well. You get all of that in one. There's nobody else out there that I know of that can give you all of that in one. There's no group. There's no one individual that is doing social work in a way that, you know, we want to do it, but is in a way that is non-traditional, but also still book by the book. Like, it's non-traditional, right, but it's still by the book. We know our stuff. And so I think that, you know, if those, you know, places are listening, you know, it goes beyond just the school settings, right? We're talking about, you know, I'm thinking healthcare settings, health systems, you know what I'm saying? Community groups, community agencies, businesses, you know, large Fortune 500 companies, things like that, where we can, you know, come in and talk about different things, whether it's be equity, social justice, mental well-being, strategies, you know, strategic planning, things like that. You know, we could come in and help build out those things or help support, you know what I'm saying? Right. And you're not going to get that from one person. I think there's a few of them out there, right? Some few of them out there that can, you know, probably do that by themselves. Like, one of the person that comes up is Kenya Crawford. She's pretty much heavy in the game and equity and stuff like that, and DEI work and consulting. But and Doc can do it by himself too if he wanted to. Like, if he wanted to, he could too. Dr. James Bell could do it by himself if he wanted to. Right. But you're not going to get that in any other group or collective or person where you can get all levels of social work and all levels of, well, like equity, social justice, community-based work, clinical-based work, out-of-the-box thinking, out-of-the-box structure, to help support, right? And to help strategize, but to also to help, you know, give that space. And so I think, again, school's back in session now. So I think that, you know, we'll hopefully get some rings here soon with everything. You know, we got one trip coming up from, you know, Alabama social work. And so that's going to be exciting. So hopefully, I think that might be our triggering point to kind of continue to push. Hey, this is what we did down in Alabama. Talked about this. We talked about that. You know, what else do you think we can do, or you need us to come, you know, to check us out, and then kind of following that trend. So I just don't think when I thought about getting all of us together and we brainstormed about it, I was like, this is a no brainer. And we've seen the benefits of it. Shout out to Wayne State, where we've seen the benefits of it and what it did for that short period of time. So now it was like, again, funding right, again. And when you're working with Black men and you target sometimes Black men, the funding isn't there. So, and that's across the board, you know, sometimes. So, and I've talked about that a lot, where it's like, well, I want to do something specifically with Black men or Black women. Typically, sometimes that funding is there, especially when it comes to like support, preventative, or well-being.
Right.
Because again, I think sometimes we think the Black community doesn't deal with life in a different manner, because we're all just American too. So we share the same issues and how we deal with stuff. It's not this case. And I'll say this, and I'm gonna stop it right here. When I had a conversation in a community conversation a couple years ago, after, you know, everything that happened to George Floyd, stuff like that. And this was white pastor was in there, and he was trying to compare me and his lifestyle, right? Yeah. Where, okay, well, he went to school and he came from middle-class family, right? And he went to school and he had to, you know, work hard to get through that. And, you know, he had to work hard to get to where he's at in this position. And I said, it's not the same. And he could not rationalize why it was not the same, because he only saw it as, okay, well, I went to school and I had a struggle. I came from middle class family, had to work there. You know what I'm saying? It's like, bro, if you cannot see the difference in your walk to get to school, I'm a first gen college student, first gen black college student, first gen master's level college student graduate. It's different for me than it is for you as this white man. We got a problem. We got a problem. And so I think sometimes it's evident. I think sometimes when people think about that type of initiative type stuff, they see it as it's not that big of a deal. But when you right. in the room with them and you can see what's happening in the moment, you know it's a really big of a deal than what it was, than what it's putting on the surface.
Right.
But if you're not in that space or you're not really opening your eyes or have that perspective to see that, you're not going to see it. So.
Right. And I also feel like that's why like they preach for us to get licensed, because they want insurance to do the heavy lifting on the funding. You know what I'm saying? Like yeah. they want insurance to kind of pick up that tab. But insurance come with like medical, like this person has I have to prove medically that this person wants therapy.
Yeah.
Unless they want to pay for it out of their pocket. But then we also talking about, you know what I'm saying? Like if we talk about equity, even with money, you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying we can't afford those things, but if we look at like this, how the systems work and how we are been systematically like, you know, left in the dust.
Yeah.
A lot of people can't, you know what I'm saying? Like, or they have, right. you know, or they think like, you know, like, you know what, this $100 can go can somewhere go else, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Or the $200. I know a lot of people charge more than $100 per hour for therapy. So I feel like, yeah, like I said, like providing funding for us to just have a space, they want therapy or they want the insurance to do the heavy lifting, which is fine. But insurance also want us to do the heavy lifting and make sure that this person needs therapy. I say that with air quotes. And then if they don't, they will want us to pay their money back. Because I've heard right. of that. I've heard of that stories where claims be like, we read the notes and can you pay us our $2,500 back? Like, damn.
Yeah, that's a major fear in the private practice world, man. I was sweating that one time, man, in private practice. I was like, man, they gonna go crazy, bro. And it just, and I was just like, man, I pray to God that they do not come back and claw that back. But I made up my mind. I was like, I'm not paying it. I can't. I ain't got it for you.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's so systemic in every level. Just because it's twofold. Even though I'm part of the system, I'm still like a bias against me as a provider in what I work with, you know, whether it be a black provider or not. But it's even worse, right? You know right. what I'm saying? From a funding standpoint, from a understanding what these therapy sessions mean to these men or women, you know what I'm saying? Like, I might not have, he might not be depressed. He might not be anxious, but the fact that we're doing 60-minute sessions to give him time to speak once a month, twice a month, or whatever, is the only time he has space to do that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And that's mental health. That's not, you know what I'm saying? And I think therapy is, I mean, we've pushed therapy to say something's wrong, right? But therapy is a space also to work through those stressors, which is life, which looks different for black people. It just does. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, brother, I feel like I had you on for, we always have a nice in-depth conversation. I mean, we can go deeper, but, before we go, speaking of pivot, we're talking about pivoting from therapy to academia to, you know, just consulting more. You've also made a pivot from like Nike and Jordans to New Balance. You've been wearing a lot of New Balances lately, brother. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I ain't gonna lie, some of them are ugly.
Wow.
But, you know, some of them are clean. You know what I'm saying? But, you know what I'm saying? Like,
the biggest hater ever.
No, that's a fact. So what was in that process of like, you know what I'm saying, trying something different, you know what I'm saying? Because I ain't gonna lie, you know what I'm saying, sometimes Jordans don't be the most comfortable shoe, you know what I'm saying? Like, they hurt, you know what I'm saying? My biggest gripe with the Jordan 11 is that it hurts.
There you go. You know what I'm saying?
The Jordan 11 hurts.
Leave them alone.
But for you in your newfound love for New Balance. Them Action Bronzes do go hard. You know what I'm saying? If I get a nice little check from somewhere, I might have to cop me a pair. You know what I'm saying? Ahead and, you know, explain, like, you know, like, what was the decision behind, you know what I'm saying, getting behind the New Balance wave?
Man, my son is a reason for a lot of my pivots, man. At this point in my life, because having two children is different. It's been different. It's an adjustment. It's two happy meals now instead of one. It's two of everything now, you know what I'm saying? So, and what happened? So I wanted to, when he was getting ready for, labor and delivery, I said I wanted to get something that was comfortable so I could run the hospital streets and run back and forth and be comfortable. And I didn't really at that point in time have any comfortable shoes that I felt was, like, you know, super comfortable. The only ones I had was my Air Max Ones. Like, I feel like Air Max Ones are, like, one of the most comfortable Air Maxes ever. But I only had my beat pair was, like, the yellow and black ones. It was kind of beat up. And then my red Curry Ones, they were still good. And I was like, I didn't want to run back and forth with them. So I said, I'm gonna give me something. I'm gonna try New Balance. I'm gonna try them out. I've heard great things about them. You know what I'm saying? People tend to wear them a lot up in DC, Maryland. But I was like, let me just kind of see. And this point in time, when New Balance was going crazy with the collabs, they was doing wild. They was wild. They opened up the playbook. You know what I'm saying? Joe Fresh Goods, and, you know, Teddy Santis and things like that. Kiff, Ronnie had stuff. And so I was like, man, all right, I like these colorways. And I wanted to try something new, man. I was evolving in my sneaker game. You know, this whole thing about, like, you know, sneakerheads, you can just be like, you should be into all the shoes. And I was like, okay, I'm doing Jordan. I got Nike. I got Reeboks. I'm one of the few people who collect Iversons, right? And so I was like, I got Adidas, you know, with Yeezy and whatever. And I was like, let me just try New Balance. And, man, I got a pair of 2002 R's, two pair of them joints, man. And they were my go-to slip on. I got to run errands, got to get the baby, got to get stuff, shoes from then on out. They were so comfortable and they were stable. Slip them on and just go. And I feel like I was, you know what I'm saying, really comfortable. And then from there, I just started following the collabs. I got the Joe Fresh Goods. I love that colorway, and it was a black designer. And I was like, I'm for all black designers. And got that and messed around. Got the Kiff Jones 990, I think V4s or V3s, I believe. And just kept continuing on from that, man. And I just wanted to be comfortable. So now I wear them to school and teach. Like, so I'm teaching. I made the mistake of teaching in ones one time for, like, oh my God, never again. Like, never. Oh my God. I don't know why I like to facilitate teaching ones, but ones are so versatile. It fit the, you know, make the mold, but good God almighty, they're not for 3-6 hours. No. So I needed comfort, bro. That's all I needed. I needed more cushion. I used to play ball. I've been playing ball since I was 5 years old. Like, stuff is starting to ache a little bit, right, in my 30s. And I just needed more support, man. And you know, J's, you can't wear all your J's like that, with depending on where you're going. If I'm sitting down, I pull those certain jumps out. But if I'm walking a lot, no. Nothing, right, is coming out. And then also, my daughter was getting older, so I knew we was going to be doing more trips and stuff like that. So I was like, I need to get a walking shoe in here so, right, I could feel comfortable. If not, I'm going to lose it. And like I said, that only point in time, the only ones I had was my Air Max Ones. My 97 was beat, but they was beat for us. They was just beat. And then I had some 270s, but my Air Max 270s, but they just not as comfortable. And I was like, I need some walking shoes because these kids about to get crazy. And they did. But I'm comfortable.
I feel you. I feel you, Cuddy. The Joe Fresh Goods is hard. You know what I'm saying? The Kith, God. Those are simple, but, like, hard, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, they're going crazy. You know what I'm saying? You only got two pair that I really don't like. You know what I'm saying? The rest of them is tight. You know,
right. Yeah. Yeah. You know. Yeah, man. So, I need comfort, man. I just need comfort, man. I can't always be in J's and all the time. And They don't fit. They don't flow.
Man, yeah, no, you're right though, because I'm gonna tell your daughter to press you about going to Disney World, and when you go, you cannot wear J's to Disney World.
Your feet will
fall off. You know what I'm saying?
I'm surprised you went to Disney World with Crocs on.
Them is comfortable though.
You got a flat foot or?
I got a flat foot. Yeah, I got a flat foot.
That's why I got a flat foot too. I don't know how you. Something with my Crocs not as comfortable either.
Those Salehi Crocs is comfortable. But also, the first time I went, I had a pair of New Balance. Ain't gonna lie, I had a pair of New Balance, but and the Crocs. So like I switched because we were there for like 4 days. So I switched off. But this time I just took Crocs, and you know it worked. You know it worked. But yeah, it doesn't seem like it would, but those ones work anyway. Anyway, I appreciate you, bro. You know what I'm saying? I know it's early for you. It's early. Shit, 6 o'clock. It just turned 6 o'clock. And yeah, appreciate you. You know what I'm saying? All the way from Portland to Virginia.
Yes, sir, man. I appreciate you as always. The Podfather is back. Y'all make sure y'all tap in and tune in. Like I said, you being intentional about it. I can't wait to see where it takes you. All right.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you, bro.
Yes, sir, man. Take care.
Yeah. Peace.